first case is Allen versus the People, case number 2011 SC29. Argument is set for 45 minutes. Are both parties ready?
Ready.
Thank you. I'm sure Mr. Gillespie is ready as well. Couple of quick housekeeping matters. You'll have to keep track of your time. And in addition to that, some of us are using iPads, so I want to let you know that. We have our briefs and our notes on them. And we're not surfing. We're paying attention to your arguments. So with that, let's go.
May it please the court, Karen Garash on behalf of Mr. Allen, registration number 18904. At issue in this case is the fourth or future risk prong of the SVP statute that requires a finding that the offender is likely to recidivate as an SVP. The statute says that this likelihood is to be based upon the results of the SORs. So the statute then constrains the discretion of the trial court by defining the evidence that guides the determination. And the evidence in the form of the SORs results constrains the finding under the statute. I see basically two fundamental problems that occurred in this case. And that is the failure to acknowledge that the, and by SORs, let me clarify, by SORs, I mean the entire SORs instrument, including the SOMB checklist scales. So the fundamental problems are the failure to acknowledge that the results of the completed SOMB checklist scales as evidence that a trial court does not have discretion to change, and the failure to acknowledge that the plain language of the statute requires that the results of the SORs and its checklist inform that determination. So essentially what we have here is the trial court received the results of the SORs, but it did not base its future risk finding on these results. It changed it. The Court of Appeals affirmed, and in so doing, it expanded the trial court's authority beyond what the statute prescribed. It said that based upon means start with. And because it said based upon means start with, its order essentially, or its opinion essentially says, consider this unless you don't like it, and then you can reject it, or you can change it, or you can gather in other assessments and other evidence as you see fit. And this, I think, is contrary to the statute. The statute says, trial court, base future risk on this. And as a result of that, the SORS was implemented in order to give this fund of evidence to the trial court. It is based, it's an empirically based bunch of information that is an actuarial risk prediction, risk assessment prediction. And I think an important way of looking at it is to maybe divide the instrument into its two parts. The static factors, as in effect in Mr. Allen's case, the static factors are much like a PSI. Its expertise is important in the creation of that document. And much like a PSI, it gathers this information for the trial court then to do what trial courts do, which is make findings.
Let's suppose you weren't supporting this particular checklist, which I assume you think is accurate and complete and complies with the statute. What would you do? Would you ask the court to take additional evidence? Or
yes, that's exactly what I would do. And I think, quite frankly, Your Honor, I think that's all it can do. And here's my explanation for that. The checklist is a different animal from the static factors, because unlike just a gathering of information, that information, in accordance with the statute, is created by expertise outside the trial court to inform as to questions 8 through 10. It is not something that a trial is within a trial court's ken. The trial court cannot fill this information out. It's not a psychologist. It's not going to conduct the clinical interview that's necessary. So if a trial court cannot fill it out to begin with, I'm hard-pressed to figure out how it can change it or correct it. There's nothing in the statute that precludes a trial court from saying, I want another one. I want another evaluation. This doesn't make sense to me. I want more. But it does not have the authority to change it.
But it could if it took additional evidence. Trial court heard evidence that maybe someone, you know, checked the wrong box, had the wrong information, didn't consider something else.
With that specific evidence, which is not present here, I think, yes, a trial court, if it's faced with the evaluator or an evaluator that says, oh, no, I didn't mean to check that. I meant something else. Yes. But of its own accord, no.
What do you mean, not its own accord, no? One of the parties has to ask for this?
One of the parties, the court's discretion is constrained by accept this information as evidence to support or deny the future risk prong. If you reject it, you lose your basis. If you don't like it, get another one. But you do not, as a trial court, have the authority to complete these checklist scales.
Counsel, would you see, I understand the argument to be that, first of all, I didn't understand the trial court to be dickering with the particular factors of the checklist, but simply the scores that were put there by the particular evaluator.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so the trial court considered itself to be constrained by the factors. It couldn't change the factors in any way.
Correct.
But it was concerned about the particular scores that had been entered. And your concern seems to be that the trial court can't go in and change a 3 to a 5 or a 3 to a 1.
Correct.
Correct. Okay. What, though, would there be a difference if, rather than going in and modifying or manipulating or changing the scores in some way, the trial court simply rejects the findings made and says, I disagree based on my experiences at trial or whatever record evidence. I simply disagree with the results of the particular assessment. Is the trial court free to reject the overall score or the overall results without manipulating or changing the scores?
Yes.
In making that prong four determination.
Yes, but by so doing, the trial court then removes the basis, at least in a situation such as Mr. Allen's, where rising to the level of SVP was dependent upon these checklist scales, then when the trial court does so, it's going to remove the basis for the future risk determination.
Even if the trial court basically reaches its own factual findings that are tethered to those factors.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor, and I think the best way I can explain that is to say, how is a trial court going to do this? Because when we look at this statute and it is creating this SOARS instrument, and it's doing so on a number of levels. The research is saying, look, we're not predicting Mr. Allen per se. We're taking this whole conglomeration of characteristics that we have found offenders share, offenders who fail and recidivate share. And if your person you're evaluating is going to fit within that to a statistically significant degree, then we're going to be comfortable saying he meets this future risk prong. And the checklist feeds into that. The checklist identifies these clinical issues that are predictive of dangerousness. But because it requires expertise, not just in the creation, coming up with these factors, but in the implementation, if a trial court, it removes from the trial court the ability to implement, is what I'm saying.
Sorry, let me try to get my microphone a little closer. Could you help me understand the difference between just simply gathering of objective information, much like we would see in PSIs, with some sort of social science subjective, and I think I have most of the forms which you attached to your brief.
Yes.
If you could show me more specifically what you're talking about, which would require that subjective expertise as opposed to simply an information gathering function.
Yes, and hopefully that will answer your question a little better, Justice Marcus. The comparison, I think, is, as I said, the static factors, much like a pre-sentence report.
Static factors, you're saying objectives. You're just calling it
factors 1 through 6 or 7 on the
prior felonies, that kind of thing.
Right,
okay.
Right. It's not information beyond the trial court's ken. It's just gathered for him.
Right.
So I liken the checklist scales here more, not precisely, but more to something like a competency evaluation.
Would you mind just showing me? Do you have your brief in front of you and what
showing the checklist?
Well, showing me what you think is something which a trial judge would not have the expertise. I guess it's page 10. That's where it is. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yes, and I'm looking at that checklist now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
I do not believe that a trial court has the authority to fill in any of it. So, and I think the statutory language bears me out because it requires an evaluator. Otherwise, you could just give the trial court the blank form and say, hey, go to town, you know, based on the affidavit. But we're seeking outside expertise because we don't have it as a trial court to begin with. And so what I'm saying then is a trial court's not going to do the interview. A trial court's not a psychologist. And I understand the Attorney General's argument and the Court of Appeals as well is saying, well, if there was evidence record to support it. But how do we know that? We are not privy to this interview that resulted in these scores. One thing that stands out to me is the Court of Appeals conclusion that, well, he tried to withdraw his plea. I'm not clear how that's relevant to any of these scales. Maybe it is. I'm not an expert. I don't know. But the point I'm making is, how do you reach into your grab bag of evidence and decide what really is within the expert's ken to tell you? I don't think you can do it. And I think since the statute says, based upon this, your decision is informed over here, then if you are unhappy with this, you need to get another one. But you can't go in and say, well, I find 1, 2, or 3. That takes the reliability out of it.
Okay. I mean, I guess when I look at these, and these are the questions that I was looking for, it's, you know, for example, one of the things is denies actual facts of the offense.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone is still taking the position that they're not guilty even after a guilty verdict, I gather they would score high on that. Denies wrongfulness of actions would be the same thing. Portrays self as victim, blames others for the crime, holds grudges against the system. If you go on down, you know, arrives on time to the evaluation. And that doesn't seem very scientific to me.
No, it doesn't. And I agree with you as a lay person that looking at this, I'm not saying, wow, that's rocket science.
Doesn't seem
but
to be.
What we know from the record here is our evaluator did not admit to any errors here. Our evaluator conducted the interview.
Well, I'm just thinking as a trial judge, I mean, I'm not sure if I read down through this list of things. You know, I would consider whether he arrived on time or not to be something which I ought to be giving a lot of deference, not only a lot of deference, but, you know, looking at it as being absolutely binding on me, which is basically the position you're taking, isn't it? There can't be a deviation without some sort of showing of an error.
Or absent an additional evaluation, because, you know, for whatever reason, Your Honor, whatever factors went into not only the creation, but why they're saying an expert needs to do this, although, you know, I think what the trial court did here is somewhat illustrative. His initial assessment before the hearing was, well, I think this guy is an SVP because he committed a sexual violent predatory act. Lay person visceral reaction, I agree with him. It makes perfect sense. But the statute is prescribing a certain fund of evidence, and it's saying how you get that certain fund of evidence. And while I agree with you, this doesn't seem like something beyond akin to, you know, someone to read down and fill it in. I don't know what took place in this interview. I don't know what, how the defendant presented himself, how the expert's expertise went into making a 3 as opposed to a 4 as opposed to a 2. And I don't think a trial court has that. That's why they say use an expert. I think this problem is gone under the new instrument.
Ms. Grash, can I ask you a couple of questions about that checklist? Now, I am under the impression, and you need to correct me if this is incorrect, that these particular, all these factors have been studied, and there's actual empirical research to support the reason for it. For example, I mean, I can dream of reasons why what doesn't appear to be important, as Justice Rice pointed out, is whether or not the person came on time for the interview, as being important because it would show over a period of time that someone who is afraid to come, I mean, over many people, would be afraid to talk to the sexual, the person that's going to evaluate them. But are these things empirically based, or are they, what are they? Are they still a work in progress? What's the...
Well, they're gone now.
These particular ones are gone, okay.
The whole checklist is gone.
Well, what has taken its place?
What has taken its place is SOARs that has absolutely no, what they term, dynamic factors. It's all static. It's all based on the historical record. So this problem doesn't arise anymore. Now you have what any trial court has when it gets a PSI. You make findings.
Well, when did that change occur?
The 2009.
Why did it?
I don't know. The handbook simply says that the checklist has been removed. I know that the new SOARs claims to predict, the SOARs that Mr. Allen was under claimed to predict treatment or supervision failure and a rearrest for a violent crime. This new one claims to predict rearrest for a sex offense. So it's a little more specifically targeted. But now the result is that you don't need the expert. You have the expert, all the expertise you need when you get the SOARs, and you don't have the necessity of the evaluator, so you just get to enter findings. But that wasn't the case here.
Well, I'm really perplexed now, thinking about the arguments yesterday and this one about what we're really doing with these series of cases here. I'd like you to tell me what you think we ought to be doing with the fact that we don't even use this instrument anymore, and you're asking us to give deference to it.
The instrument, as it stands, is relevant to Mr. Allen.
Why? I mean, who instituted the change, by the way? Was it legislative? Was it this group of experts who decided this checklist didn't work out, didn't mean anything, was too subjective? What?
Yeah, the SOMB who is charged with revising the SOARs itself, creating and revising the SOARs itself. So they empirically or periodically do what they do to determine its reliability and have determined to get rid of this. The issue that remains in this case, despite the checklist being gone, is, I think, the Court of Appeals definition of based on. Because to define in this context based on as start with doesn't make any sense given the instrument we're dealing with. The statute says, trial court, based on this. This is based upon empirical actuarial risk prediction. And from that, we want you to decide this.
But what is the effect of using this instrument at the time that your client was affected by it? Is it the civil issue about notification and community protection?
It's what you use along with the remainder of the SOARs to meet the fourth prong of the SVP statute. So the Court of Appeals language expands. It's basically saying, okay, start with this empirically based document and then consider anything else you want, which pretty much obliterates the empirically based document. I think what remains once you take the checklist out is that that language from the Court of Appeals, I think, needs to be confined to what is the plain meaning of based on, meaning the foundation for the groundwork of.
Counselor, thinking about your argument and the way it applies to this particular checklist, and your, it seems to be tethered to, look, this evaluator is going to be in the position of interviewing the defendant or the offender and coming up with these, this range of scores based on that interview. In light of the new SORS that's being used and the fact that only static factors are being used and that's drawn from other parts of the record, mm-hmm. how does that impact your argument and how we should interpret based upon beyond this case? I mean, the statutory language hasn't changed, and we're going to have to come up with an opinion that interprets the statutory mm-hmm. language, whether it applies to this SORS or the current. And so how does the nature of the underlying instrument impact that?
In that situation, under the new instrument, as I understand the Attorney General's argument, that constrained to the new instrument, it makes some sense. In that, as I said, I liken it to a PSI. The expertise comes in the document wherein they identify, you know, prior offense, not full-time employed, whatever factors they deem to be statistically significant.
Right, and so if the evaluator checks the wrong box or and the court has access to record mm-hmm. evidence that
yes.
is clearly contrary to that, then...
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
It's based on the evidence. It's not a fund of evidence on its own.
Ms. Gresh, can I ask you a question? In terms of how we should view the interpretation of based upon the results for the fourth factor, whatever, fourth... I guess, first of all, your position is that the judge shouldn't tamper with the actual score. I got that. But let's say the judge just disagrees with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now what degree of departure can he or she have with respect to disagreeing with the conclusion in this case?
Judge, I think the best answer I can give you is if we're saying this is a fund of evidence from which questions yes. 8 through 10 are determined.
I got it.
I don't think you disagree with evidence. It either supports a proposition or it does not support a proposition.
Oh, sorry.
And I think that's what the statute says, Your Honor.
It says based upon
it
the results.
Based upon the results.
Right. So the results say that the results of the expert says, of course, there's a lot of other material about your client.
Yes,
that's here, included by that evaluator. It's rather detailed description of all his problems over the years, as well as
yes.
So, to me, it seems the fundamental job under Section 2 is to make a determination based upon all of the evidence. It may be a narrower form of discretion with respect to the fourth factor, it doesn't say you got to do exactly, judge, you don't have any say about
likely.
Doesn't
have to do exactly, like I said, he has discretion to seek more, but I think it goes back maybe to Justice Marcus's first question yesterday, which is, I don't think that language, risk assessment, means the SOARs for purposes of SVP. All that other,
means that fourth factor, I understand.
Yeah, the other evaluations, the static 99, isn't necessarily relevant.
I think we understand that.
Okay.
The real issue is how do we relate this? I mean, you're making this argument today because it fits the facts of your case, because there's only the fourth factor, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, we have to decide how to interpret what, based upon the risk assessment. So mm-hmm. if it doesn't mean you have to follow it 100%, which I think you probably would agree with, right? You don't have to follow it. I mean, the trial judge here in this case maybe we would all agree, or some of us would agree, that you shouldn't be tampering with a clinician's
But isn't that
scoring.
A discretion without a difference, Your
No,
Honor?
I don't think so, because there's still a discretion.
But how do you exercise it if you're constrained? It seems to me the argument's flipped on its head. The discretion comes in the first three prongs of the statute. The discretion
So you're saying you have to follow it 100%.
I'm saying the discretion is this. Take it, use it to support or not support the prong, reject it, lose your basis, or get another evaluation.
But could I ask you real quick, where does the get another evaluation come from?
The get another evaluation is stemmed from my assessment of this as evidence, and I don't think anything ever precludes a trial court from saying, I want more.
It says based on this evaluation, right? And
right.
You seem to be taking a very hard, rigid position that means you can't consider anything else, other evidence.
It says based upon the source, including the checklist.
Uh-huh.
I do not read that as constraining a trial court from getting another source and a checklist if he has some problems with this evaluator or some visceral, I don't think this is right. But
is there a limitation on the number of?
I'm sorry.
Is there a limitation on the number of evaluate? I mean, is this a situation in which you're saying he can keep getting evaluations until he gets 20 likes, or?
But I think, really, if you get two, you got your basis, right? One of them's going to give it to you, one of them isn't, or they're both going to say the same thing. So you're going to have a fund of evidence.
But let me ask you this, because I think you're making a very radical proposition. You're replacing. I'm just going to put it as far out as I can. The judgment of a person who sits in a courtroom day after day and has to look at all kinds of different defendants and has an obligation to the community, mm-hmm. Based on informed discretion, I'm going to use that term. How does that comport with the whole way why we have judges in the first place?
Well, because I think it's distinct from your typical sentencing decision wherein that discretion is paramount. This is based upon a fund of research that is identifying characteristics from which you're putting your client or the defendant in or out of in order to make this assessment. That isn't necessarily an act of discretion, it's an act of expertise.
Okay, who gets the benefit of the doubt, the defendant or the community, when we're talking about this civil provision for protection of the community against a person who might be a recidivist, a violent predator?
Where's the doubt?
Yeah, where who gets the benefit of the doubt?
Well,
the community or the defendant?
I guess where I am, I'm not sure I think that question is applicable, because the fund of evidence prescribed by the statute to make that determination will support it or not. There's not going to be a benefit of the doubt or a great...
Well, it's a listing on a registry, basically, right?
Yes.
Okay.
With reporting requirements.
And the reason, the policy reasons, state and federal, for that registry and notification provision is what? Just play it back to me. What is the policy basis for
it's
having such a thing?
Protection.
Okay, so
the Court of Appeals, in any event, has determined it not to be punitive.
So what kind of discretion does the trial judge have now if the trial judge has some serious doubts
if I
about whether or not putting the person on the register is the right thing?
If I accepted your proposition, I guess, or what you're telling me, that there is some sort of gray area, that there was a sliding scale of offenders in this regard versus those that were going to establish that prong or those that were not, then I think that would be an exercise of the trial court's discretion.
Well, in Greece, you went to the oracle, right? Prophecies are, it's hard to be in the prophecy business.
Right.
Right? So there's some public policy behind the legislative's choice of words based on.
Judge, I think the answer is the sentence is reflective of discretion. Give them a big, long sentence like they did here, 20 years. But the source is reflective of expertise.
Let me ask you, I'm sorry, did you want to go ahead? I wanted to ask you a quick question. The trial judge here went into SOARS and changed the numbers. He said, I would have given him a 5 instead of a 4, whatever, essentially manipulated it so that the number came out right so that he would be SVP. Would you be taking a different position if what had happened is that, you know, I respect the value of this, but based upon my observation and experience as a judge, et cetera, I'm rejecting it, and I'm going to sentence him to say that he is a sexually violent offender despite this?
Judge, I understand the reticence of constraining a court's ability to do that, but I don't think that statutory language allows that to happen. I think that they constrained the discretion because they wanted the expertise to this prong only. So I don't think so.
Grash, can I ask you one question? Good morning. The issue that I have with going back and retaking the test is the reliability. My understanding is the reliability of testing, psychological testing, deteriorates the more times they take it because they learn how to score well, basically. If I were defense counsel on this, I would say, man, you got to change what you said about portraying yourself as a victim. How do we factor that in if that's what the remedy is to do a second test when it may not be as reliable? Does that make sense?
Yes, and I think, Your Honor, in all candor, I think that underscores a problem. But again, when I return to the statutory language, I don't see another solution. I think that problem is gone now. I think Mr. Allen was in a really narrow window that is closed, in that determination. But I can't offer you a solution to that problem because I feel that the statutory language constrains the result and that leaves only that option for a trial court.
Thank you, Mrs. Grash.
Good morning. Kathy Gillespie for the People, registration number 26109. I want to start by saying that the SOMB, that Part 4, has changed, and there is pretty extensive documentation for why those changes took place in the handbook that explains why the different factors changed. And I can't give it to the court reliably based on memory, but it is in there as to why, and the actual studies of the last 5 years that they've done on the sex.
And again, tell us how the handbook is available. Is it in this record? Or
Parts of it are in some of these cases, but yeah. It is available online, and it's cited to the online site in my brief. So if you plug that in, it should pull right up for you. In addition, as the court noted, this problem is going to remain with us because the statutory language isn't changing, even though the evaluation may be changing. And the problem that we have, that the defense attorney doesn't have, is we have to come up with a system that's going to work for everybody and not this particular defendant. So my position, taking into consideration everything we talked about yesterday, is this judge did it exactly right. He took the evaluation.
Wait a minute. That's totally inconsistent on what you were saying yesterday. I'm sorry. I know Mrs. Grash was there, so. He tampered with the clinician's. Are you talking about the ultimate conclusion?
Are you talking about tampering?
He tampered with the clinician's expertise, you know, and all that.
He did. He disagreed with the clinician's answers on a few of the questions.
Which is not the place of a layperson, including a judge, right? I thought that's your whole argument. We had to pay attention to what these guys say.
No, my argument yesterday is there's a framework for the SVP designation, and the legislature told this Sex Offender Management Board to come up with that framework. You tell us what are the important things to look at when designating somebody a sexually violent predator. I argued yesterday and today that the trial court has discretion to disagree with the findings on the relationship and the findings on here of this fourth prong, the risk assessment. If he sticks to the factors, not the answers in the factors, he has to consider the answers because it's an expert. And we don't, you know, obviously we don't want this to be the...
But there's got to be a difference in the discretion between the fourth factor and the first three, right?
Not in my mind.
No? Even though the language, statutory language, is a little stronger, isn't it?
It's more specific. I don't think it's stronger. And that's the point we disagreed on yesterday.
Can I just...
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Why do you think the judge has... Now, the construct that you drew for us yesterday, as you said, we have to give respect to these factors, and that's how we're giving respect to expertise, essentially.
Correct.
Is by giving those factors. And so everything basically follows from that. As long as you limit your consideration to those factors, you're okay as a trial judge, is basically what you're saying. You can move your opinion within those factors. So if, for example, you observed something in the courtroom, which happens, you know, and as a result of that, you feel you have a certain feeling or whatever, you don't think you can take that into account, or you slip that into your thinking in terms of one of the factors? I mean,
I think that for the SVP determination, it needs to be one of the factors that you're looking at, because we want to stick to what's relevant to use resources to designate somebody for community notification. Now, those things that the judge may be seeing in the courtroom may be directly relevant, and I'm assuming that they would be, to the sentence itself. But I think if, for instance, here, what the court did, to Justice Hobbs' point, is do I think, and Justice Marquez, is do I think the court should say in its ruling that, you know, I disagree with this, I'm finding him to be an SVP? No, because I don't think you can review that. Then there's no review, because you don't know what he based that on. But as this court did, if you call the evaluator in, he took more evidence. He didn't ask somebody to go out and manufacture a new evaluation and give him the benefit of the doubt that, hey, you really need to show up on time because you missed this scale by 1 point. But what the trial court did was exactly what he should have done. He should have called that expert back in and said, I got some concerns about this. And he started with pillow being used as a weapon. The probation officer and the evaluator admitted that question was wrong. He also admitted on the deviance scale that he was basing it on self-report, and he actually got Dr. Wright to admit that that could be a basis for that. The erection, keeping an erection throughout the entirety of the crime, is whether or not he's sexually aroused. So the court looked at what the SOMB told us is important about designating these people as violent predators, asked that evaluator very specific questions about why he answered things certain ways. And even on the deviance and the motivation scale, where it's more of a, you know, 1 to 5, we're going from not at all up to the most, he got Dr. Wright to admit that, I gave the defendant the benefit of the doubt. The SOMB is very clear that it is not the benefit of the doubt to the defendant. It is the benefit of the doubt to community safety. And that is written in the instructions in the evaluation. So my framework allows the trial court to use its discretion, tells the court what factors are important, just like it does in sentencing. You should look at criminal history. You should look at, you know, the impact of the victim. It gives them the factors that it should consider. And then this court did it textbook perfectly, called the evaluator in. So now you, or the Court of Appeals, as it did, can look at this and say, historical findings of fact, clear error. Are those findings sufficient to support the SVP is de novo review? So you've got protection for the defendant, you have everybody operating off the same factors that the experts have told us are relevant to their future level of dangerousness and their predatory behavior. I can't find a downside to it.
Can I just ask to make sure I understand? So you're basically agreeing with Ms. Goresh that it would be improper in terms of what the statute says, being based on these, on this evaluation. It would be improper beyond what the statute allows for a judge to consider other factors from his own experience or with regard to the nature of the crime. If I'm understanding you right, you're saying, no, he can only consider the factors that have been created by the SOMB here for the evaluation, but he can, through cross-examination or whatever, disagree with the evaluator and come up with a different evaluation himself, as long as he limits himself to the things the SOMB said should be pertinent. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Although I wouldn't call it a different evaluation. I would call it the I think this stays as it is. It's evidence for the Court of Appeals to review. But the court, in its discretion, can say, I disagree with you on questions 1, 2, and 3, and here's why. And in this facts of this particular case, Dr. White admitted it too. So it protects the defendant and the community, because there are going to be evaluators that make mistakes. There are going to be rogue evaluators that don't know what they're doing and don't follow.
So when you said that the doctor admitted it in this case, is that suggesting that he changed his own report and agreed with, and so basically under cross-examination or whatever you want to call it, the judge got him to change his report, and that's okay. But you said in this case, which suggests to me you don't think that's required, though. Even if the evaluator said, no, you're wrong and I'm right, the judge could still change the outcome of the report as long as he's only considering the factors that the SOMB said he could consider.
Correct, because he's basing it on the factors that the SOMB says is relevant. And the only part I take issue with is he's not changing. The evaluator's opinion is the evaluator's opinion. But the court can disagree with that opinion if he's using the same factors, and there's something to support it, which is where I think you get into trouble if the judge simply says, I disagree, and I'm finding him to be an SVP.
And you said that the first time, too, but given what you just said to me, I take it, even if the judge supported very well his consideration of other factors, having to do with the nature of the crime, other things about this, even though it's something we could clearly review, and he's made great findings, you're still saying that's improper. He can only base it on these factors that the SOMB said he could base it on, or said he could base it on back then.
Yes, because that's what the General Assembly told the SOMB to do. For this risk factor, you and the Department of Criminal Justice need to go out and develop an instrument that is going to tell us what is important about looking at risk.
Well, that's why I think, I understand your argument, that's why I think what you're really arguing for is a much narrower discretion with respect to the fourth factor than the other three. And I also would like you to, how do we do the, since I suggested factor, using the word factor yesterday, may have been a big mistake. How do you apply that to the stranger?
Apply it to stranger?
Yeah. How do you apply the factor analysis?
Because going back to yesterday, keeping in line with my framework, I would use, one, you go to the plain language of the statute. Clearly the statute, 183.414.5, says whose victim is a stranger to the offender. From the plain language of that, there's a very reasonable argument that that's looking at it from the offender's perspective. However, if you do that, taking into consideration why they instituted this sexually violent predator law, it leads to absurd results. Because who it leaves out is the offender who stalks his victim, the person who abducted Jacob Wetterling, the person who killed Jessica Ridgway. Those defendants, the most egregious, are the ones that stalk their victims without their victims knowing that they're being stalked. So if you interpret it that way, I think it leads to absurd results. If you go to the SOMB's definition of a stranger, and I'm going to do this off memory because I don't have it in front of me, but it talks about the victim not knowing the offender or in such a casual manner. If you take the facts of the Hunter case, if you follow the SOMB definition of stranger, Hunter may not fit. But if you go on to promoted, you will find that it does fit.
I just want you to focus.
So I would go to the way the Sex Offender Management Board defined stranger, because I think if you look at all three of those categories, because of the way they define them, they start with a stranger that the victim doesn't know, or like in the Candelaria, in this case.
So I'll read it to you. The victim is a stranger to the offense when the victim has never known or met the offender, or has met the offender in such a casual manner as to have little or no familiar or personal knowledge of said offender prior to the current offense. I think that's still...
That is.
That's the current one as well. So you would use that definition?
I would use that definition.
And apply and have the judge apply that.
And I would have the judge apply it, which is why Alan was considered a stranger. They had said hi twice. if you apply that definition to Hunter, may or may not fit. If it doesn't fit and you continue on, you'll find that it does fit in promoted. So by using those definitions, if you look at the way they've set up stranger, established, and promoted, it covers the three. It covers the person where they don't know each other.
Here's this problem for me is that basically, since there isn't an express delegation of rulemaking and that procedure wasn't followed, there is some kind of other statutory construction rule, and I'm sure it's in the toolkit, everything is, having to do with looking at a statute, but maybe it does go both ways. Stranger must go both ways. The legislature couldn't amend it one way or another because there's a victim and there's an offender.
Correct.
And so, you know, the facts do inform, a range of facts inform what the legislature meant there. I'm concerned about, one, a hard and fast definition of stranger, about whether we can really render that. I do think there's some deference based on the way that the legislature wanted this. I'm going to call it a civil instrument now for a civil result. Some kind of deference to the body or board that is looking at the potential applications of this informed by their expertise. So it's not, you know, it's not absolute deference. It's some kind of consideration. But basically, we're talking about a de novo responsibility here of this court, right, to interpret the, construe the statutory language.
Correct.
So where does that leave us? On your day and a half of experience.
And
all your preparation up to this. What is it? What are you asking for? What deference, if any, should we give to this board?
I'm asking you to give complete deference to the board in coming up with the definitions, because I think this instrument works. It comes from when you look at the people on the management board, they come from every walk of life and every position, defense attorneys included, judges included. They have the experts on that board to give them the information, and you're talking about a civil designation and how we're going to spend resources about who we're going to community notify. Give the court's discretion to fix mistakes, oversights that are made, but have them using the same page of information. It gives consistency to the defendants, notice to the defendants. It gives guidance to the trial court, tells them what's important to look at. As the research goes on, these documents are only going to get more and more accurate because it's going to be based on evidence from the actual people that we've targeted as needing community notification. There is no downside to using the definitions that have come up within the Sex Offender Management Board, because you, Justice Marquez, you know, looking back at it last night, your question about promoted and established, you know, doesn't that include every sex offender? Looking back at the facts of the case and what I'm presented with on appeal, not having read necessarily the trial record in all of those cases, I'm not sure that Gallegos fits. Now, as a trial court, my decision would be, I don't think it fits. And Uribe Sanchez is just a bit closer because there was a time period from morning to evening, but I do think that there are a lot of defendants that are sex offenders that are not going to fit within those definitions. And we know that because a lot of these trial courts have been using the SOMB definitions, and we've only designated 500 out of 10,000. So somewhere it's narrowing down. And my concern about using the dictionary definitions, I just think it's way too broad. And I don't think it gives enough guidance to the trial courts, the DAs, defense attorneys as to what everybody's looking at. And I think with this type of a designation, it needs to be based on research because it needs to be effective. And if a judge gets the PSI and sees that this guy is never going to be on community notification, and he feels that it is somebody that should, then he's Hunter and he gets, you know, 253 years and we move on. But we're talking about a board that has been put together by the legislature. And again, I would encourage the court, if you read through the lifetime supervision statute, in every aspect of that lifetime supervision, the legislature says to the SOMB, you make up the guidelines, you make up the structure, you fill out the evaluations, The court needs to consider those evaluations and make a decision. And if they disagree with the decision of the experts, then they need to justify it in the record. Every single aspect of these sex offenders, they've deferred to the SOMB. It makes absolutely no sense. Subsection 3 and those definitions aren't given that same deference in this system.
If I could steer you back to the facts of this case, to the particular evaluation in this case, I saw a rough distinction between the factors around the use of the pillow as a weapon, as something that the court could draw from evidence in the record and his own understanding of, you know, what is a practical matter constitutes a weapon. Same thing with the sexual arousal piece and the back and forth with the evaluator on whether that needed to be throughout the offense or whatever. I saw that differently from the subjective scale where the court was basically saying, look, all things being equal, thou shalt err on the side of public safety. And I was looking through the instrument itself, and perhaps you can point me to the directions that you referenced earlier, where, as you said, it's very clear that that is, in fact, the default. I mean, all things being equal, you should tip the scale in favor of public safety. Where does that appear?
It's in the handbook itself. I don't think it appears on the...
On the checklist.
It's not on the evaluation itself, but it is in the handbook, and Dr. Wright actually references in his testimony.
Okay, I will look for that. But I found that to be interesting because that seemed to me to be the trial court's basis for saying, hence, all things being equal, you should have given the guy a 5 or a 1 or whichever direction the scale needed to tip.
Right.
Higher on the deviance and lower on motivation. And I just found that to be kind of an interesting basis for the trial court to be essentially modifying the score, or at least the basis for disagreeing with the score that was given.
And I would agree with you. I mean, and the SOMB and the evaluator admit that these are subjective scoring. I think where, in this particular case, where the distinction came up was when Dr. Wright specifically said, I gave the benefit of the doubt to the defendant. As opposed to, I came up with a 3 because of these 5 factors. And in addition to the court saying, all things being equal, you need to err on the side of community safety, I think that was in direct response to Dr. Wright's testimony about the benefit of the doubt. But in addition to that, the court then listed facts from the crime itself that supported his obsessed with, you know, deviant sexual practices. I mean, he gave specific examples from the record and then talked to Dr. Wright as well about the fact that when you are analyzing the SOMB checklist, you are coming from the current crime and the interview that the defendant's given as part of the evaluation process. Now, there is a summary of the interview in the bigger evaluation. But again, that would be where I would expect the trial court, if you're going to disagree, then you better, you know, call him in or get some evidence from the record itself as to why this particular thing was scored. And I think having the evaluator on this particular checklist itself, because of the concerns you raised where it's a little bit more subjective, that's where I think having the actual opinion of the evaluator and discussing where the trial court has issues is important for the trial court to justify what it's doing, because we do want to give deference to the evaluator's opinion.
But the gist of my question is simply, you would agree then, or you're representing that is expressed, that default position, err on the side of public safety, is written somewhere the manual. Okay, I'll look for that. Thank you.
And if it, and then, you know, in the situation, if it wasn't there for some reason, then I think in that case, it would be a much closer call. And I don't know that then the record would support the trial court's findings.
That's exactly the basis for my question. Thank you.
So I think that's where, again, this framework works. There are ways to make sure that the trial court's doing its job as well as the evaluator while still giving an ability to review what's going on. Does that answer?
Counsel, can I get you to switch gears just for a moment and think about this case as an administrative law case
instead of a criminal law case. I know you you look like you don't want to do that. But I ask you because just following up on what Justice Hobbs asked, there are different degrees of deference that we could pay to an administrative agency, which I'm drawing analogy to the board here, and you haven't analyzed this case in that framework at all. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if you have given that any thought. And just to give you an example, I think in administrative law, it really does make a difference if a board has changed its position, which it has in this case, I think, right? I mean, you're suggesting that we should pay, trial courts should pay absolute, they are bound by the factors. However, the board here has changed the factors. So I'm wondering how that might play into your deference argument.
That it's changing?
Yeah. I mean, in the sense that, if I hear you right, a trial court is absolutely bound by the factors and cannot look at other factors, regardless of something that the trial court observes in the courtroom. He can't consider that, right? Unless somehow he manages to put it in a factor. Well, now we don't have those factors. The board doesn't use those factors anymore. And so it's interesting you're taking the position that the trial court observes something and cannot deviate from the factors, but the board apparently deviated from its own factors. And in traditional administrative law, we need to look at that.
And I agree with that. I mean, I think that it cuts both ways. And it favors the framework, one, because we are looking at a civil determination. We're not talking about any criminal liability, and we're not talking about punishing somebody based on this constantly moving ball. But from the nature of the sex, from the nature of the study of sex offenders and how it is evolving as we go through and have studied these individuals and their crimes and how it affects the community, I think that's one of the reasons why the legislature said to give it to the Sex Offender Management Board, because they're the ones that are constantly reassessing what they're doing based on hard evidence that they're finding from this analysis that's constantly ongoing. And so, you know, I'm hoping, more and more accurate as they go on. And so that's another reason that would concern me about having a court-dictated definition or factors, is that it makes it very difficult to keep that up to date with what we're learning on sex offenders. And so I'm not familiar with administrative law. I've spent my entire career in criminal, but I know that there are certain procedures that have to go through in order to get something to an administrative law level. And I know that this list didn't fit those parameters. And so I didn't really analyze it in that, because I don't have the basis to support it from that. But I do think that those factors are changing, but as they're changing, they are still being changed in this particular instrument based on ongoing research. And so that's why I think it's important for the court to stay up to date with what the SOMB is saying. Now we've had 5 more years to study. As we now start designating people and see reoffense levels, here's what we're finding. Here are the most important factors. And things are coming off and, you know, being added and dropped off based on a track record, which is, you know, an unusual thing to have when you're basing it on this. I mean, you know, you talked about yesterday the family law situation, you know, and that there's certain levels of deference. But again, you have to look at what you're looking at. And in that case, I think your question was towards, you know, terminating parental rights. That's a whole different ballgame than designating somebody to go into an office 4 times a year instead of once to register and having community notification. And so that's, you know, I agree that it's changing. And to a certain extent, I can see why a court of law would be uncomfortable with giving deference to something that's constantly changing. But
it's not necessarily giving deference to something that's constantly changing, but perhaps saying that the trial court can't change the factors, but the board could come to that conclusion. You haven't been able to provide us, I guess, with a reason, and I don't know why the factors were changed, but let's imagine the trial court came up with the same conclusion that the board did, that this factor just isn't working, and something that happened in the courtroom, I think, is quite relevant. But unless the board says it, the court can't make that determination, even though the board might come to that conclusion,
well,
you know, next year.
I think the difference between that is that the court is basing its decision to consider something relevant based on the court's experience. You will have some judges that have a lot of experience dealing with sex offenders. You will have a lot of judges that have absolutely no history with sex offenders, and understanding them and the things that studies have shown about recidivism, all of that. And so you have to have a system that deals with those two types of judges. I mean, I can name 10 off the top of my head that I wouldn't have any problem changing these, but I can also name another 10.
You want to make a list for us, sir? Are these evaluators still in business or not? Do we have a group of evaluators?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so who are
they? Have to get on the list. From the Sex Offender Management Board keeps a list and qualifies them to be of a certain level. And
so there's some oversight group here that, what, looks at the peer record of these folks? And who are they? Are they licensed psychologists, psychiatrists?
They are licensed psychologists, and the legislature gave the authority to overlook those people to the SOMB.
Could I ask one follow-up on that? Do you? I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no.
Just one broader, then. So given the interpretation you're asking us to take of the statute and the delegation of authority, do you see any constitutional problem, had the legislature decided to do it, in just cutting the court out altogether and just letting these people designate people sexually violent predators and requiring them to register?
My gut would be yes, but
I mean, the court seems to have no discretion here.
But the courts do have discretion, so they're looking at these factors. And if you know you have a evaluator that says there's no criminal history, so this guy can't have promote or can't promote it or can't not have established a relationship. And the court, or he says he has a history, and that's why he established the relationship. And the court gets an official criminal history that says he has no history of this. There's got to be some way to protect the defendant from that designation if the information is flat out wrong. And if there's not court oversight, and when you look at these factors, Justice Ide, I mean, there are very few. It looks at all the things that you would common sense would tell you as well is somebody that's going to be a predatory sex offender. So I do think that there would be a problem if the legislature said, I'm going to pick this particular person and I'm going to tell you that whatever he says goes as far as community notification and registration. And that's why they told the parole board to use this as well when they're coming out, and lifetime supervision to come out. So there's a reason why this whole standardized system was put in place. And I think there is enough of the statutes to give the court a basis to find that that was actually statutorily delegated to the SOMB.
The chief has given me permission to ask just one more question. Sorry. So why isn't this follow-up on Justice Coates? Why wouldn't this be similar, at least as you're postulating it, to the division we now have between the criminal courts and DUI cases in the Department of Motor Vehicles, where, you know, the court sentence, do whatever they do, but then the Department of Motor Vehicles essentially has civil consequences. You lose your license, you have to go to classes, whatever. That doesn't seem to be what you're arguing for either, quite. Is that right?
Well, I think that certainly would be another way to do it.
But that's not what the statute has done. And since the statute hasn't chosen to do that, I mean, the only deduction or the only thing that I can conclude is that the courts have to have an intrinsic role here.
They do, and I think I've given them that intrinsic role by having them have discretion to look at these factors that they think are relevant and make their decision on those. And when you look at the depth of all those factors, there's a lot of area for these trial courts, and these five cases are a perfect example of that, of where this discretion is moved.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gillespie.
Thank you.
Ms. Grass, since we've run over, we'll give you about 4 or 5 minutes to say something if you'd like.
As
just a quick clarification, I think. I don't think I'll need the full 4 or 5 minutes, but during the course of the hearing, the Attorney General's right, the evaluator said, yes, I gave him the benefit of the doubt. He also said, I take his statements with a grain of salt, being who he is. He also said, I factored him a little higher because of the offense. So once again, that is something within his ken. It's not in the trial court can't fill it out. So how does he know how to correct it is the point I maintain. Secondly, I don't think you can take the court out of it under the old or under the new. The static factors, which are the points at which the evaluator admitted error, the static factors always required what is traditionally within a trial court's purview, which is based upon this expertise that we're giving you, these list of factors, make your findings, enter your order. This was a very narrow 3 questions on that entire SOARS. Not in all cases would it have been determinative of the final score. But the court's role here was to remove it from risk prediction and essentially make it a math problem. He did not understand that it was not predicting Mr. Allen. He did not understand the actuarial risk prediction research that it underlies it. So he picked a couple of areas and he bumped up a couple scores and he bumped down a couple scores. And he did this, and I think the record will bear me out with this, with the intention of achieving the SVP result.
Could I just sort of ask you the same question then? Your position is that what the judge should have done if he had some concern was to ask for another test. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's the limit of his discretion, right? Essentially.
That's in this narrow window.
Sure.
Where this was determined.
Sure. And so why isn't this like the Department of Motor Vehicles? I mean, you know, why don't we just have a whole other agency determine, an agency, not a court, determine whether somebody is a sexually violent predator? And they can just get the tests and impose, you know, depending upon the statistical numbers,
well,
a civil penalty.
I think that as to this, that point might be valid. But as to the entire source, no.
Why not as
because
to the entire source?
Because it's evidence-based. And that means...
then what does the court do differently than it should have, than it did here? With respect to the entire SOARS.
As to the entire SOARS, mm-hmm. my position is that this is evidence. Evidence is what we use to support or not support a proposition. By statute, the court was required to use the results. And the results are not something the trial court could garner. It had to be created for him. As to this, if it is relevant for the ultimate determination, which it was here, then the trial court's constraint is tightly constrained by the evidence, as it is with any evidence. But as to the static, the trial court is a fact finder, like it is in a PSI or like it is in any other point where it's...
How would that be different than the Department of Motor Vehicles would take a look at, you know, what the blood alcohol level was? That's a fact finding.
It is, but you're also talking about in the context of the entire statute. And I think that sort of brings me back to the point that I think this discretion restraint is flipped on its head. I think giving a trial or removing a trial court's discretion to determine whether something fits within a statutory criteria, such as, you know, a relationship, is an entirely different animal than saying, hey, trial court, you need our expertise. You can't figure this out. We're giving you the research. So use this. Rely on it. And the point being, you don't have the expertise to alter it, which leads to what I understand you're saying is a extreme removal from the trial court's discretion. But again, it's not discretion. It's the application of evidence based on expertise.
Thank you very much, Ms. Smith. Well, all those cases are submitted on the briefs.